This episode contains descriptions of sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised.
Now I have no idea what's going on. And it's just turned violent. And I can't get out of his car.
Normally, this is where I tell you where someone grew up and about their early life. But Keith Smith can tell you himself.
So Caitlin, I grew up in Lincoln, Rhode Island, which is just north of Providence and 6 miles from the Massachusetts border. I have 2 older brothers, 2 younger sisters, and a younger brother.
It's a big family.
It is. Yeah, there were 6 of us. But we would literally walk down the street to pick up our friends, you know, so that like 8 of us could walk to school at the same time. But you'd come home from school, you would do your homework. You'd go out for a couple of hours and everybody would go home for 5 o'clock dinner. Everybody. And at 6:30, we're back on the street until the streetlights came on.
Of course, being from the Northeast, Keith played hockey.
I was in a league of 14 to 18-year-old kids. I was 14. I was a defenseman. Not because I was big. In fact, I was tiny. I was probably 5'10". I know for a fact I weighed 110 pounds. The only reason I was a defenseman is because I could skate backwards better than most of the other guys. But I loved it. It was spectacular. And I was coached by some fantastic men. Mr. Ostergay and Mr. Richards. And Mr. Richards owned a barbershop. And it was March 1st, 1974. I went to Mr. Richards' barbershop with all of my other skating buddies, hockey players, for a team meeting. I hitchhiked home. I'm pretty sure my parents probably thought another parent gave me a ride home. I'm 14 years old. I don't want to bother anybody. I never asked anybody else for a ride home. Just didn't do it. And a car pulls over. It's a purple AMC Gremlin with a white stripe, a big white stripe down the side of it. It was by far the second ugliest car ever manufactured by AMC, American Motors Company. The first ugliest car was the AMC Pacer. Google them, take a look. And as the guy pulls over, the passenger door opens. I didn't have to open it. He opened it. I get in, I close the door, and I tell him I'm going to Hartley's Pork Pies.
Hartley's Pork Pies was and still is a locally famous restaurant.
I tell this knucklehead that I want to get off at Hartley's Pork Pies. He drives right past it. That's okay. I'm not panicking because maybe he doesn't know where it is. There's a fire station maybe 100 yards, a football field length away. And I say to him, I'll get out at the fire station. And he goes right past it.
And is he saying anything at this time?
He didn't say anything after I got in the car and told him Hartley's Pork Pies. Let me out at the fire station. He says nothing. And at that point, I know something's not right.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. The man was still driving silently away from where Keith wanted to be dropped off.
I tell him, if I don't get home soon, people will be looking for me. He says nothing. I gotta tell you, at that time, my oldest brother was a civilian employee of the FBI in Washington, D.C. So the thought in this 14-year-old boy's head is, I've been picked up for a reason. They're gonna take me somewhere, maybe slap me around a little bit, make me walk home with a message from my brother.
While Keith was trying to figure out what this man was up to, he was also doing everything he could to remember details he could give to the police later.
He had white seats, fake leather white seats in an AMC Gremlin. To the best of my ability, with my right hand, I started scratching the right side of the passenger seat, just to leave marks there. I'm looking at the inspection sticker on the lower right-hand side of the windshield on the passenger side of the car. So the license plate number is written in a magic marker, you know, a Sharpie. PY879. If I told you I said it 100 times, I'm not exaggerating, and I'm underestimating it by a factor of probably 3 or 4. There's no conversation in the car other than me in my head going PY879, PY879.
While repeating PY879 over and over to himself, he was also trying to figure out a way out of this car.
As he passes the fire station, he goes to take a right at a corner where there's a bar there called Kernan's. The Kernan's were friends of my dad. So I figured I'll roll out of this guy's car. It's a 90-degree intersection. He's got to slow down. As soon as he slows down, I'll open the door. I'll roll into the parking lot. I'll run into Kernan's, and this is going to be over. So as he makes that 90-degree turn off of Smithfield Avenue onto Grafton Street, I already had my hand on the door handle. I yank on the door handle, put my shoulder into it like a hockey check, put my shoulder into the door, and the door doesn't open. And the left side of my face explodes because he, with his right hand on the steering wheel, he reached over with his left hand and punched me in the side of the face and told me, don't do that again.
When the man picked Keith up, he had opened the door for him. Keith hadn't seen the man lock the door from the inside.
I don't think he can do this anymore, but back in the 70s, the lock on a car door, you know, where the window goes down into the frame, the locks are there, right? Back then, there was a screw that came from through the door up to that frame where the window goes down. There's a screw, and the lock was just a cap that you screwed on. So what this guy did was he had unscrewed that cap, and when he opened the door, he pushed it down. So when I closed the door was locked, and there's no way to pull anything up. So he had rigged the car so that once somebody was in it, they weren't getting out.
But Keith was totally unaware of this at the time. He was just a 14-year-old boy trapped in a car with a stranger. But he knew his town very well and didn't stop looking for opportunities for escape.
We take a right, and we're going to head down past Lincoln Downs, which at the time was a thoroughbred racetrack. I know where I am. The road that the racetrack is on is also a road where the Rhode Island State Police Barracks is on. I'm like, this is fantastic. And I'm waiting for a cop to pull up behind us. Because if the cop pulls up behind us, in my mind, I'm going to grab the steering wheel of this guy's car, pull as hard as I can, create a commotion, the cop's going to pull us over.
But there were no cop cars in sight. And now they were heading towards Lincoln Woods.
I'm looking in the passenger side door rearview mirror, not a headlight. Lincoln Woods is closed after dusk. You don't want anybody in there. So the next spot on this road is one of the entrances to Lincoln Woods. And I said to myself in my head, if he pulls into the woods, he'll kill me. Why else would you pull into the woods? If he takes the left, he takes another left into the woods, like on a gravel road. And it's pitch black. I can see nothing. And he got out of the driver's side. And this is good. I'm in the car. He's out of the car. So I lean forward over to the driver's seat because I'm going to get out his door because he just opened the door from the inside. My door doesn't. But as quick as I could think about that, I needed him to be far enough away from the driver's side so if I got out, he couldn't get me. So he's like now in front of the passenger side where the headlights would be. I start going for the driver's door. The passenger door opens. He grabs me by my legs and pulls me through and puts a belt around my neck and drags me out of the car and raped me. Next question.
After the assault, does he just get back in the car?
He's still saying nothing. Well, like later on, I told you he said nothing. He was saying nothing then, right? He went back to the car. I was still out standing outside of the car. Now, I'm in the woods, and I have no explanation for this. But he didn't kill me. Although I thought a couple of times. No one wants to acknowledge that they might be killed. What I did say to myself was, if I live through this, he will pay. It's amazing how the brain works. I knew there was a possibility I might be killed and left in the woods. But something inside you says it's not going to happen and you're going to live. So he gets back in the car. I'm alive. I have no explanation for this. I get back in the car. What more could he do to me?
The man started to drive, making lefts and rights that Keith could track the entire way.
And he drops me off at a store called Cody's Meat Market. It's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night now. I get out of the car. He got out of the car, just like he did in the woods. He opens up my door, and I'm not getting out because he's out. You can unlock the door, but I'm staying in the car. And when he is standing in front of like the headlight on the driver's side of the car, he's as far away from me as he's going to get. I open the door and I get out. And I look at him. He gets in his car, not saying a word. And I realize it's time for me to go. When you pull into a parking lot, sometimes you see those cement things that are about 4 inches high. Okay. I looked and one of those cement things was broken into pieces. There was a piece at the end broken. It was bigger than a softball. So I picked it up, went to the back of his car, and I threw it against the window, the rear window of his car. With no intent other than I'm scared, I'm afraid, I'm violent.
Then he ran. The most direct path home was to cross the street and cut through a bowling alley's parking lot.
I don't know why I didn't run into the bowling alley for help. I didn't. I ran up the hill behind the bowling alley. It's March 1st, the ground's frozen, I fall, and I took a pretty hard tumble, right? So I'm running, I'm scared, I trip, I fall, cut my face, banged up my hands.
He ran past all the houses of his friends, Greg Randall, Ricky Flaxington, Mark Catalan. Even though he would be safe in any of these homes, he didn't want to stop at anyone's house but his own.
All I wanted to do was get home. A car comes, we're in back streets off of Main Street. And I'm convinced it's the guy, and he's gonna come back to kill me. So I hid under a car. I dove underneath a car and stayed there. And I could see the headlights coming, and it dawns on me, if it is him, I'm stuck because I can't get out from underneath this car. And the headlights roll right past me, and they keep going. And when I think he's far enough, when I think whoever's in that car is far enough away, I get up. I make it a couple more blocks. I'm running. I'm terrified. Then I make it home. And I collapse on the stairs. Because I'm home, I'm safe. And my brother Brian, the civilian employee of the FBI, is on the phone. He was visiting that very weekend. And my brother Brian sees me, and he instinctively, I'm crying, I'm dirty, I'm physically dirty. And he comes to me and picks me up like in a fireman's carry and yells, "Dad, come here." My father comes out of the den. I didn't know who was in there. It turns out my mother and my two sisters were in there. Caitlin, I wasn't in the house for 60 seconds. They get me into the car, and we go to the Lincoln Police Department for help.
So you didn't even have time to tell your dad and brother what happened?
We talked about what I was willing to say. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed. I'm guilty, right? I'm embarrassed. I'm a 14-year-old boy. I was raped by a guy. I'm ashamed of that, and I'm guilty because I was hitchhiking. That's not why I'm guilty. I was hitchhiking, and when I got in trouble, the 14-year-old, 110-pound guy didn't fight hard enough. That's why I was guilty. I want to say that the distance between my parents' house, the house I grew up in, and the police station was probably 5 minutes. And I'll tell you, for the first 4 minutes, I was nothing but crying in the backseat. So there wasn't a conversation. You get into the police station, my father says something, a cop takes us into the station, takes us downstairs. And the Lincoln Police Department has the lowest level, and they put me in a room. A detective comes in. I'm sure my dad and my brother were there for a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. But then a detective came in, and they were told to leave. And I, you know, in hindsight, I think it's because they want that victim to feel free to say things to a stranger in law enforcement that you wouldn't want to say in front of people you know or love. I didn't know that at the time. All I know is I'm in a room with somebody I don't know in the basement of a police station, and my only saviors, my brother and my dad, are on the other side of that door. My dad's helping me. My brother's helping me. We go to the police department. Of course, my dad knows the cops. Of course they're going to help me. He's a detective. He's going to help me. I pour out my soul. I tell him everything that happened. He's quietly listening, not saying a thing. And when I'm done telling him my story, he starts with, "Do you know this guy?" "No." "You've never seen this guy before?" "No." "Are you sure you've never seen this guy before?" And now I'm like, oh, I thought this cop was gonna help me. Now he's aggressively questioning whether or not this is a stranger. "How do you know so much about his car? How do you know so much about what he looks like?" I could tell this cop the clothes he was wearing, the length of the sideburns on the side of his head, Yeah, people had sideburns in 1974. The color of his car, his license plate number, you know, I told the cop he was left-handed. The cop said, how would you know that? I said, because he punched me in the face with his left hand. Like, literally reached a car, right? He didn't give me a backhand.
Keith told the detective the license plate number of the ugly purple gremlin.
On the door, a cop comes in, hands Mike, the detective, a piece of paper, and the license plate says PY879. It's got the guy's name. So not only was my guy arrested for, quote, unnatural sex acts and booked in January 1967, he was arrested for molesting a child in 1973 and did time for it. And he was arrested for the interstate distribution of pornography. This son of a bitch got released in November. December, January, February. 3 months later, he's cruising Lincoln, Rhode Island in his car looking for boys. But the cops' demeanor and his attitude switched 180 degrees. And he leaned into me. He leaned across toward me. And he said, you did a good job, Keith. You did a good job.
After that night at the police station, Keith didn't tell anyone what happened. Not even his other siblings.
Other than my brother and my dad, no one knew that night. Then we get to the police station and a couple of cops knew. I kept my mouth shut. Again, I was embarrassed, ashamed, and guilty. So I went to school a couple of days later. I'm not telling my friends. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed. I'm guilty. You think I want to tell my teachers? You think next Friday when I go to my hockey coach's barbershop for my coaching session, I'm going to mention it to my friends? Hell no.
So Keith tried to live his life as regularly as possible, with a few irregular disturbances.
I'm in school. Somebody comes in, talks to the teacher, and the teacher says, Keith? I go up, and she goes, you need to go to Mr. Broad's office. Mr. Broad was the principal. And as I walk into the principal's office, there's two uniformed cops there. He said, you need to come with us. Like, I'm not going anywhere until my dad shows up. My dad shows up. We go to the police station. I go into a room. And they lay out like 15 photographs. They didn't lay them out, Caitlin. They gave them to me in a stack. I laid them out. So they said to me, can you identify the guy? And I'm going through this thing just like a deck of cards, looking for the seven of diamonds. And I'm going through it and I take his picture and I drop it over there and I go through the rest of them and that's him. I never felt more proud.
The man's name was Ron Coleman. While waiting for the case to go to trial, and without any outlet to talk about what happened, all the internalized feelings were eating at Keith.
But I became an angry kid. Angry. Really angry. I didn't act out. It was all internal, but I was angry. And my head was on a swivel. The doctor told me I was hypervigilant. And I would walk in and scan the room. I could immediately assess who might be a threat. It's a horrible way to live. But it was going to keep me alive. So I did everything I normally would do, right? I went fishing in the pond across the street. I continued to play hockey. I was hanging out with my friends. But I was always aware. My world changed because my innocent life as a 14-year-old boy pre-March 1st in this bucolic little town became a place of random sexual violence, spontaneous danger. And I didn't like wake up and want to do that. I woke up and it was just part of me now, right? So that's how I lived.
3 months after the attack, Keith was called to testify in front of a grand jury.
We go to the grand jury. My dad's with me. A detective is with me, the chief of detectives. But I'm going in. And Caitlin, I got a crew. I got gun-carrying cops. I got my dad. I got another guy. So I'm like, I'm surrounded. It's like an entourage. I'm going in and I'm terrified because I don't know all I know is I got to go to court and tell my story. But I'm okay because I got my backup. And they open those big wooden, beautiful mahogany doors or oak doors. They open up the doors and there's a room and there's a guy at a podium and a bunch of people sitting down. And I walk right in because I'm going to do it. I'm sending this son of a bitch to jail. He's going to pay. If I live through this, he's going to pay. And I go in. And I hear the doors close behind me. I turn around. The detective and the other guy are not there. I'm in the room by myself. And I'm like, I've just been abandoned. I said, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And the prosecutor's got me at a podium. And he's telling me what the process is, right? He says, Keith, we're just going to ask you a couple of questions, and we want you to tell your stories and be truthful. I remember him saying, be truthful, because I'm sitting there going, they didn't believe me originally. I'm like, that's okay, because they believe me at the end, right? So this guy, I've got nothing. My story is so vivid and so ingrained in my head. I've got it. I can do this. And I get up there and I start telling my story. The whole grand jury, in the mind of a 14-year-old, they were blue-haired old ladies. And maybe 2 or 3 minutes into my story, they're crying. And so am I. So I finish, a couple of minutes into it. I don't remember the questions. I'm sure they asked me a couple. The prosecutor asked a couple of questions. I answered them. He thanked me. I walked out. I'm shaking. It was one of the worst moments ever because I had to relieve it. And I had to, and I knew that based on what I said, he was either going to be held accountable or not. It's all on me to put this guy away. He was indicted.
Ron Coleman's trial was moved back, then back again. This part of the story obviously wasn't in any news articles. It's what Keith has pieced together over the years from people in his town.
Well, it turns out I told you he was a distributor for pornography. And President Nixon's Commission on Pornography, Google it, was trying to crack down on the distribution of pornography. So the cops kept the guy on the street to press him for information up the chain. And it turns out, Caitlin, it was a sit down between the cops, some people who were earning, that this guy was earning for, and men in my town, guys who loved me and knew my family. And as long as this guy stayed out of Lincoln, Rhode Island, did wait for his trial. In the meantime, the cops are pressing him to see who he's working for because they had a much bigger case. And these aren't Lincoln cops. They're not even probably the state police. In 1974, I keep going back to it, but Nixon's Commission on Pornography was on the news. I mean, it was big. So I'm sure, I don't know for a fact, but in my heart, I believe the feds were involved with this.
So the cops wanted Coleman to stay out of jail so he could maybe lead them to higher-ups in this porn distribution ring. The porn distributors wanted Coleman to stay out of jail to keep making money for them. The men in Lincoln, Rhode Island, just wanted him to stay out of city limits. All Coleman had to do was stay out of town. He could be near town, he could be just outside of town, but coming into town wasn't going to be tolerated.
I'm driving my bike, riding my bike, my little orange 10-speed down Smithfield Avenue, and he drives by me one day, going in the same direction as I am. It's an unmistakable car, but more so than the car, it's purple with a white stripe. But what I saw was the license plate, PY87. I stopped my bike. Do I go home or do I go to see this other guy? And this other guy was much closer to me physically.
And he was a friend of the family.
Right. I go to his shop and I'm shaken. He takes me to a curtain. He pushes the curtain back. And there are two guys sitting at a table with 3 handguns on the table. And that didn't shock me. And I sat down, and I never felt safer. And I don't know whether they were buying guns or selling guns, or they were just there, and they were having a conversation, everybody's gun was out. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line was, the guy who raped me a while ago just drove right past me on a street in my town.
Keith's family friend took him for a ride around the neighborhood.
I think he's looking for the guy. He probably was, but he was also making sure I knew the guy wasn't in the neighborhood anymore. He pulls up to my parents' house with a white picket fence. I get out of this car. He calls me over. The window's down in this car. He reaches over. He puts his hand on top of my head. And he says, it's going to be okay, Bambino. It's going to be okay.
So to recap.
So he was arrested. I picked him out in a photo lineup. I go to a grand jury. He's indicted. Trial dates are set. Trial dates are postponed. Trial dates postponed. I see him on the street. 3 weeks later, he was murdered.
On August 18th, 1975, Keith woke up like any other morning.
It was just a regular day. I'm sitting at the kitchen table. So the phone rings, my mom answers it and says, buddy, it's the police. No big deal. My dad goes to the phone.
I hear him.
This is it. He says one word. He says hello, and he hangs up the phone. My dad hands me a $10 bill and tells me Cumberland Farms was like the original 7-Eleven in New England. So he says, go to Cumberland Farms, get me Dutch Master cigars. That's what he smoked. And the Providence Journal. Caitlin, there's only two newspapers in Rhode Island. The Providence Journal, the Republican paper, and the Pawtucket Times, the Democrat paper. The Pawtucket Times was the only newspaper allowed in my house. I actually said to him, you mean the Pawtucket Times? He said, get me the Journal. So I jump on that same orange 10-speed bike. I ride over to Cumberland Farms. I walk in. I get the Providence Journal. There's got to be something in there. I thumb through, and there's the story. Here's the headline. I can't get it out of my head, like his license plate. This guy lived in the next town, Central Falls. It's called CF for Central Falls. It says CF man, 29, beaten to death in Providence. It could have blown me over just with one of those, because I was a melting piece of nothing. Because I'm reading his name, he's dead. Like, beating man, well, it's in the news. Mm-hmm. Ronald Thomas Coleman of 66 Washington Street in Central Falls. And I'm reading it, and that's him. That's a guy. I'm overwhelmed. I can't even explain the emotion. Happy, sad, anxious, angry. And right across the street from this Cumberland Farms is Luxury Car Wash. And out of the car wash is a guy I know. So I immediately just pedal my bike across the street. He puts his window down. I'm crying. I'm shaking. And I said to him, he's dead. He's dead. He's dead. But he said to me 15 words I'll never, ever forget. Don't say anything to anybody. There were a lot of people looking for that guy. I didn't say who was dead.
The Providence Journal wrote at the time that Ronald T. Coleman was found outside a liquor store, lying unconscious in the street shortly before 3 a.m. He had been beaten and had severe head injuries and a broken leg. Police were called to the scene when the liquor store alarm was set off, apparently by a rock being thrown through a window. Nothing had been taken from the store.
Do you think how the story played out for your attacker was justice?
I do. So, you know, I had to figure out why me. And probably 25 years ago, I came to the answer. And I need to believe this because it helps me deal with why me. This guy had been arrested, as I mentioned, in 67 and 73, and then again 74 with me. When you advance to the point where you're arrested and you've done time, you've done it multiple times and you never got caught. So I'm guessing he might have had dozens of victims. Okay. I'm not trying to be a martyr. It's not my role. But I believe that what happened to me had to happen to me. Because he died at the hands of people who knew me because of what he did to me. And he never did it again to anybody else. It's justice. I talked about the sit-down, which I know occurred, between people he was earning for, some cops, and some people who had my best interest at heart. So this isn't vigilante justice. There was an agreement reached. But then he came into my town and they broke all the rules. So the agreement in the sit down was violated and he had to die.
And is that also how you know but don't know how or who killed him?
So in my heart, I know who killed him. In my heart, I've never been told who did it. I think there were a couple of guys involved at the scene when this guy's life came to an end. One of the newspapers wrote that at the scene, they recovered three pieces of evidence. A broken wristwatch, the heel of a man's shoe, and a leather belt. I was dragged out of a car with a belt around my neck. Nobody knew that, except the cops I told and my dad. Now my dad told other people, who leaves a belt at a murder scene? The only way a man's leather belt is left at the murder scene, it had to be by somebody who knew I was dragged out of a car with a belt around my neck. I don't know who did it. I'm never going to ask. But that belt tells me it was somebody close to me. And I'm glad they left the belt.
After that, it was just over. There was no court, no real investigation into Coleman's death. According to Keith, it was unofficially considered a public service homicide, and that was that. Unfortunately, Keith had a whole other set of problems to focus on.
One thing that always strikes me from a lot of these stories is once a bad thing happens to you, you are not exempt from other bad things happening to you.
Yeah. Caitlin, I'm so glad that we have the whole opportunity to talk about it, but I'm really, really glad you brought up the health stuff.
Yeah.
I told you I played hockey. Mm-hmm. Played hockey in the summer. 14 years old, 110 pounds, defenseman against guys who weighed 200 pounds and 6'2". I'm black and blue. September comes. It's time to go to school. So I go to see Dr. Hannah, the family doctor. And he draws blood. I go about my business the next couple of days. Just like when the cops came to the school, I'm playing hockey. They stop the practice or the game. Mr. Richards, the coach. Smitty, come here. I skate over. Guess what? Two cops. Not the same two. They're like, you need to get off the ice. There's an ambulance coming for you. Like, I'm not going anywhere until my dad gets
there. But of course, you must have thought it was something to do.
I had no idea. Now, this is like a year later, right? My dad shows up. Boom. Put me in an ambulance. They take me to a hospital. Okay. They put me in pediatric intensive care. They literally strap me to a bed. They stick a needle in my hips and they start extracting bone marrow. It was the most excruciating pain I've ever felt because you can't anesthetize in the interior of a bone. It's all pressure. So they suck out bone marrow out of both backs of my hips. They keep me in intensive care. They move me out of intensive care a day or two later. My mom shows up into the intensive care room where I was supposed to be staying. The bed's made. She breaks down. She thinks I'm dead. Obviously, I'm not dead. So I have a disease called idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura. It is an autoimmune disease. There's red cells, white cells, and platelets. Platelets make your blood clot. My immune system recognizes my platelets as foreign, as bad, and my immune system destroys them. So ITP, I don't want to say it's common, but it's out there. And typically it's in young women. It's in women having a child. It's rare that if a boy gets it, it's rare that it sticks around. If it sticks around for a while, they pull out your spleen, because typically your spleen is your spleen's a filter. As your blood runs through it, your spleen's typically defective. It's destroying your platelets. They pull my spleen out, that's not it. In the meantime, they're running tests for leukemia, all kinds of cancers. And I had my 15th birthday in the hospital on October 7th. My friends came, it was a blast. For years, I've been through literally 12 surgeries. You wouldn't know it by looking at me, right? But I've been operated on 12 times, missing a spleen, a gallbladder.
Living with ITP means Keith gets blood tests every month if his platelet counts are good, and every week if they start to decline. And if they get really low...
I literally have permission to call the Richmond University Medical Center on Staten Island and tell them I'm coming. I call my doctor's office night or day, and they admit me over the phone. So when I walk in, they're ready for me. Because when your platelet count is that low, single digits, you run the risk of a spontaneous brain hemorrhage. You can bleed in a number of places. You're going to bleed in your brain. You're going to bleed in your lungs. You're going to bleed in your kidneys. And you don't have platelets to stop. So you're just going to bleed to death.
Years passed. Keith had a successful career in finance, managed his ITP, raised two daughters, and didn't talk to anyone about what happened to him that day he hitchhiked home.
I went to Providence College in Providence, and I remember in my sleep reliving not the night, not the hitchhiking, not the actual rape, the run home. I'm reliving in my sleep infrequently. I get a job in New York, they move me to Dallas, they move me to Chicago, I worked in London, I worked in Zurich, back to New York. And as the years went by, the dream in my perception of the run home kept becoming more and more frequent. So now I'm back living in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, working in the city. I went to bed, and I woke up in my closet with the closet doors busted on top of me. I don't remember how I ended up in the closet with those doors busted on top of me. I do remember. That's just it. I was having that flashback that I was running home. I leapt out of bed and I ran right to the closet doors. But the first time, I leapt out of bed in my sleep and ran. I said, that's it, I need help. I talked to a couple of people, a couple of therapists before deciding on this one doctor. And he was fantastic for me. And I know that sometimes people go to therapy because they really need help and they want help and they're open to help. They come across a therapist that's not necessarily right for them. And they go through it a couple of times and they feel that therapy's not the right thing. It's not working. I would encourage folks, if you feel that you need therapy, you do. You're just going to work your hardest to find a therapist that's really going to help. And then after about a year, I stopped because I'm under control. I got it under control. During COVID, I was back in therapy in Lower Manhattan, one block off of Wall Street with a female therapist. And she was fantastic for me too.
Keith also got involved with organizations that help survivors of sexual assault without telling them why this cause was so close to him.
A beautiful, beautiful woman named Evelyn Gill. Evelyn created an agency called Prevention Education, Inc. And Evelyn and a woman named Martina Davidson and a couple of other women put a program together in a Trenton YMCA to counsel female victims of rape. It was incredible. And then they grew it to a crisis intervention counseling program for everybody over the age of 3. I told her I wanted to support her agency. And I asked if I could come talk to her about the work she does, because I was willing to throw bucks her way. Right? So we had a nice conversation, and I never told her. And I was put on the board for a total of 16 years. And for 6 of those years, I was president of the Board of Trustees. And we had a wonderful, beautiful woman named Dr. Juanita Brooks, who was responsible for crisis intervention counseling. Evelyn was the executive director. Dr. Brooks was the clinician.
And one day, something just changed. And Keith didn't want his assault to be a secret anymore.
I left one of my therapy sessions and I went straight to them. This was like a year into therapy. I went straight to them and I needed to disclose to them. I go in to see Evelyn unannounced. I go, Evelyn, I got something to talk to you. So I go in, she closes the door, and I told her. I said I was abducted, beaten, and raped by a guy when I was 14 in Lincoln, Rhode Island. She looked at me and she said, we know. And we both cried. Bottom line was, because of my involvement, she knew. Like, you know, you don't do this. And I said to her, but maybe it was somebody I knew. She said, oh, no, we knew. So I said to her, who's we? She said, me and Juanita. I quickly ran out of Evelyn's office, went to Dr. Brooks and told her the same story. And me and these two women were hugging in their offices and all of us are crying because they knew. They knew. So, but that was 35 years after this. And I kept quiet. And when I went public in a big way.
After being silent for decades, Keith decided to write it all out in a book.
I wanted to get my story out to tell people, if you've been through some kind of sexual trauma and if you can speak about it, you don't have to. I waited 35 years. But if you can speak about it, do it. Because I know you're all afraid of what the outcome's going to be once you speak out. And I only hope it was as understanding and loving and supportive as it was when I spoke out. And I find that people, I think I've documented this, I've spoken with more than 100 survivors of sexual abuse, assault, and rape. And I tell you that 80% of them tell me that when they did speak out later in life, that the people closest to them understood them and loved them and supported them. And the other people, forgive me, they can go to hell.
Keith's book, Men in My Town, was published in March of 2009. About a year later, journalist John Baker heard about Keith's story and wanted to do an article about him for the Pawtucket Times. Keith agreed, but before the article came out, he needed to talk to his family. After that night when his dad and brother took him to the police station, they never spoke about it again. And even though the book had been out for months, some of his siblings were still completely unaware of what happened to him, even though his sisters were home when Keith collapsed on his stairs after the attack.
My mom and my sisters were in the den with my dad. So when they came out, my dad came out, my mom and my sister were still in the den. They didn't even see me. When we came home, my mother's like, "What's going on?" And my father said to her, 1974, my father said to her, "Something happened to Keithy. We're going to take care of this." And that was it. And I had never had a conversation with my mother, as unbelievable as it sounds. We had never discussed it between 1974 and 2009. Never discussed it. So my sisters were totally unaware. I go into my parents' house and I tell my mom, "You know, I wrote a book." She says, "Yeah." Caitlin, she's actually said to me, "We don't talk about that." And I said to my mom, "We don't have to talk about it. I'm just going to tell you. It's on the front page of the Pawtucket Times tomorrow. So all your friends are going to know."
What did your siblings, the other siblings, what was their reaction when they found out? And was that from the paper?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if I got on the phone and talked to them or they called me, like my friends were calling me. But much like I said this before, and I wish everybody who discloses goes through the same experience, and I'm so sorry to say, I know it's not the case, but my two sisters and my younger brother's a cop at the time, right? The three of them were incredibly supportive and loving and understanding and welcoming and warm because I'm somebody they love, you know? And their reaction was spectacular for me. I just wish it was for everybody.
Keith knows that the circumstances of his assault made it easier for him to be believed.
And a lot of people aren't believed because when they disclose, it's years after the assault. And I understand why people don't disclose immediately. I had no choice that night. I was beaten and I was raped. And it wasn't by an uncle or my hockey coach or the guy down the street or a school teacher. It's by a total stranger. And I said to myself, "If I live through this, you will pay." And I knew when I was out of his car, hiding under bushes, and if I got home, I would walk to the police station myself if nobody was going to take me.
Do you think maybe because it was a stranger and not someone you knew and was someone in your community, that made it easier to disclose?
It was absolute. That's absolutely true. I had no idea who this guy was. He was going to pay. Right? And over the last 10 years, I speak publicly about my story. And I've literally had conversations with more than 100 victims of abuse. Almost all of them, up to 98 of them, were abused by someone known to them or someone known to their family. And only one other guy was abused by a stranger. I wasn't groomed. I tell folks, my rape, it was a random act of spontaneous sexual violence. Almost everybody I've spoken with was groomed. And they didn't see that violence, and I'll tell you why. If you're 6 or 7 or 8 years old, boy or a girl, and somebody's grooming you, and they're doing things to you, and they're telling you that this is how people show love, then when you're 6 or 7 or 8, that's what you believe. And then you're 9, 10, or 11, and you go, "That's not right." And the number one reason they didn't tell anybody is because they felt complicit. I let it happen over and over and over again. It's my fault. And they've been told by the groomer, if you tell anybody, they're not going to believe you. So now what happens is the child feels complicit in their own abuse. And they should never. Anybody who's hearing this, I'm telling you, don't. You're not complicit. You were manipulated. But then they get the courage to disclose because they want to put an end to the horror that they live with. And they disclose to someone they trust. And most, here? Why are you lying? Why did you let it happen? Why would you say such a thing? That didn't happen. Don't ever say that again. So you didn't disclose because you felt you were complicit. You got the strength to disclose and you were called a liar.
But once Keith had disclosed his story, he was willing to tell it to anyone who would listen.
I'm a speaker for something called RAIN, R-A-I-N-N. It's RAIN.org. It stands for the Rape Abuse Incest National Network. And I speak for them when they have an event, when they have a need to have someone go talk in the New York City area. So Oprah did a show called 200 Men. I was on it. I was invited to participate in it, and I did. Anderson Cooper did a story after the Penn State sex abuse scandal, and Cooper's story was called Penn State, State of Shame. I was on that show, right? Been interviewed by the New York Times, the Providence, the Pawtucket Times in Rhode Island.
During all this time, Keith was in and out of the hospital dealing with ITP. After his platelets had dropped several times, Keith and his doctors finally found a correlation.
We did a timeline of when I was in the hospital and events in my life. Raped in March. Obviously very, very sick in the summer. Hospitalized in September. I should have been hospitalized earlier. And then we started doing it. When I was in the hospital in Chicago, what was I doing? I mentioned that Oprah had 200 guys in, filmed two shows. 6 weeks later, I was in the hospital. I never made a connection. I've spoken publicly at a couple of events, and typically within a month or two, after a major event where I expose myself by doing these things, I'm hospitalized in the need of IV intravenous immune globulin to keep me alive. Wow. Now, one of my doctors today, a highly trained, brilliant woman, has been studying. She's a MD, research, PhD, and she's studying the effects of trauma and stress on autoimmune diseases. I'm 99% sure that the trauma on March 1st did something to my body on a cellular level. You know what I got? I didn't catch a disease from this guy.
Right.
It's not genetic. It's not hereditary. I can't pass it to anybody. I can't share it with anybody. It's just mine. And now, 50 years later, I truly, truly believe that my autoimmune disease is directly related to the stress from the trauma, which triggered something in my body that's wrong. And revisiting that stress, that stressor, or revisiting that trauma can sometimes reactivate my immune system to do something wrong.
After all he's been through, Keith has an incredible peace about his life and what it would look like for it to end.
It's my own personal moral belief. Your time's up, it's up. And if I bleed out, I bleed out. I mean, if they try to keep me alive, the DNR states there's three things. You got a brain, you got a heart, you got lungs. Katie, my daughter, knows any two of those three are gone, let me go. If only one of them's gone, keep me around. There might be a chance.
Yeah.
Right? So when I said I signed a DNR, those are the rules. If my brain's not functioning and neither is my heart, but I can breathe, I'm gone. Let me go. If my brain's functioning and I can't breathe and my heart's not beating, let me go. You get the idea, right? Any two of the three, let me go.
Now, I know that sounds incredibly morbid, but Keith is fine with how things turned out for him.
Earlier, I said I truly believe that what happened to me had to happen, so that people who loved me or knew me could do what they do, what they did, to put an end to this guy's reign of terror so it never happened to anybody else. Right? Now the answer to your question, what's my life like today? I wouldn't change a thing. Because if I changed any one thing, I wouldn't be exactly who I am today. Health related, getting raped, getting dragged out of a car and built around my neck, having my two beautiful daughters. I worked all over the world. I got great people in my life. I wouldn't change a thing. I'm not a martyr, but I'm pretty happy with my life. Actually, that's not true. I'm very happy with my life. I got people who love me. There are people I love. And I wouldn't change a thing in the past, because you change one thing and then today changes. And I'm not, I wake up, I wake up every day. I know people say this, they're all full of shit, but I wake up every day happy that I made it through the night. And when you truly, truly live that way.
Yeah.
And every day is a gift. Every day. I was on the subway yesterday. I closed my eyes because I could hear this. It's the subway. It's just, are you ready for this, Caitlin? I enjoyed it. The sound of the wheels on the subway on the track. It was the one train coming out of 42nd Street, you know, going down to South Ferry. But there are things like that, right? There are sights I see, there are sounds I hear, there are smells, there are people I meet that just tell me life is beautiful. Now, it's had some bumps. Those bumps made me who I am.
To speak to someone at the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, call 1-800-656-HOPE or 1-800-656-4673. You can also live chat with someone at rain.org. That's rain.org. This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.